Minita was like the second hashtag that put a spotlight on the fact that a lot of female architects didn't get the recognition. And that's something I, since 2018, strive for. I think as a journalist, you just write. People always think that it's easy, but it's not that easy. It's quite a complex profession. Meditation can seem a bit far away, but everybody breathes every few seconds. So it's the most normal thing we do. Control that. Yeah, it's perfect.
Hello, Charlotte. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Bastiaan. Nice to be here.
Thank you for being here. I'm really excited. Can you share a little bit how your work week looks like? Because normally I ask, where are we? Can you describe it? But for this time, we're at my place.
We're at Bastiaan's house, which is also quite interesting for me to see our living environment. But my normal work week, I work at home. And that's in Amsterdam at KNS Zemlaan, a very pretty building by Rapp and Koolhof. It's called Piraeus, maybe known under the few people who studied at the TU Delft. And we have to be at our office one day a week. And the office is located in Zeist, which is not super close by. But yeah, it's one day a week, so everybody makes the effort to go to the office. And the office is by VMN Media. It's a huge publication firm. And they have a lot of titles, and the architect is one of them.
So I see a lot of posts by you on social media, and it feels like you're never at the office and never at home.
Yeah, a lot of people always say that to me. They're like, do you ever have rest? Why are you always everywhere and nowhere? I'm actually quite a few times in the week at home, but yeah, I love social media, and I love sharing images of the urban space and architecture, so every time I go out of the house, I make pictures and I share them.
Thank you for doing so, because I'm a lot at home, so and I see a little bit of the outside. brings me to the first question. How's life treating you at the moment?
Good. It's a bit busy because, yeah, BOVAG, the vacation of the building sector is approaching. And at the magazine, it's always a stressful time because we need to finish all our deadlines before the vacation happens. So it's a bit busy, but nice. Good busy.
Good busy, not stressful.
Sometimes a bit stressful, but I'm a person who needs a bit of stress to create articles and
some pressure.
Yeah, some pressure. And I like having deadlines to work to a certain point and finish everything.
Do you also have habits or systems to deal with stress, for instance?
I meditate a lot. Yeah. I know that sometimes people think, well, meditation. But I do everyday meditation and breathing exercises to level me a bit, because I'm quite an enthusiastic person who can sometimes lose herself ambition and passion for architecture. So I need to meditate to bring it down every day.
I think this is a very good tip.
Yeah.
I got it a lot of times, but I'm not the person to actually do it. But sometimes I tried it and I do understand why I do it. It's maybe I should do it more often.
Yeah, but breathing exercises.
Breathing I do a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a tip of my psychologist a few years ago. Right. Yeah, it's closer to you as meditation, because meditation can seem a bit far away and a bit zweverig, like we say in Dutch. Mm-hmm. But everybody breathes every few seconds, so it's the most normal thing we do. And if you can control that, yeah, it's perfect.
Can you describe a little bit how this exercise works? I'm asking because I found out, like many people probably do, there are a lot of exercises about breathing. How many seconds you inhale, rest, and pause. And how do you know this works for you? And if it doesn't work, did you check other ways to do it?
Or? Yeah, I figured it out with my psychologist a few years ago. But I used the 4-7-8. I know there's one like a breathing exercise who works as a square. You breathe in 4 seconds, hold 4 seconds, out for 6. Yeah, I do the 4-7-8. That means you breathe in for 4 seconds, hold 7, and breathe out for 8, which works the best for me because the breathing out part for me levels it down. I can feel the stress going out of my body. So that's a good one. I know that they use it in the military also.
Yeah.
They do the square one and the 4-7-8. So tip, try the 4-7-8. And I do it. Yeah, for 5 minutes at least, and then sometimes for a 15 minutes, but you should try it for 5 minutes. Otherwise, you don't feel the benefits of it. Then it's too short. Yeah.
Really nice.
Yeah.
Hey, your background is in art and architecture history. Why do you currently hold a position writing about interior and design?
Good question. That's my current position. But I studied art history in Belgium and I did a master's. And then my second year, I already discovered that my passion was in architecture and especially also in heritage. I was 24 years old when I was finished with my studies in Belgium. And I had a professor, Bart Verschaffel. Shout out to Bart Verschaffel. He also writes a book about architecture philosophy. And he told me, yeah, you're way too young to go into like work life and you should study some more. You should do an extra master's on just architecture history. So then I moved to Amsterdam. And in that year, it's at the Vrije Universiteit in Amsterdam. There was also a course called Design History. Yeah, and I was hooked. I thought it was so interesting to see how design evolved the last couple of decades, how interiors evolved. I think the scale of interior is super interesting because it's everybody lives in an interior. This is quite an intimate space, but we also have urban interiors. So I was intrigued by that scale. And then the position at the architect came by and they were searching for someone who knew a bit about interior and design. And that's how I rolled into that position. And I'm not a journalist, so I learned the whole writing just by making articles.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So a lot of the people who work at the architect, almost all our editors are not studied journalists. They are just passionate about architecture.
How do you do that? Learning this craft?
Starting, to find interesting subjects that you are passionate about and starting to write. And I have an editor, Merel Pitt. She's also my manager. She's really good at writing. So in the beginning, I got a lot of feedback, especially because I'm from Belgium. And how we get educated at university is totally different than in the Netherlands. We always say in Belgium, writing is a bit bollig, complex. Mm-hmm. And in the Netherlands, it's quite straight to the point. It's the same as how Dutch people speak. They just say how they think.
Yeah.
And that's a skill that I needed to learn to put that also in my writing. I was used to writing long sentences and making beautiful metaphors. And that was all not necessary. So also my professors at the Vrije Universiteit, they said to me, "Shut up, tone it down. What do you want to tell the reader? Make it not that complex and straight to the point." So at the architect, I also learned that way more. And then Merel, she helped me with a lot of tips. And I'm still learning. I'm doing courses on it. But I think as a journalist, you just need just write. People always think that it's easy, but it's not that easy. It's quite a complex profession.
How do you know now if a text is well written?
Well, Merel and I, we find out a structure that works for me. Because I always have the feeling that I need to tell everything in a story. So I first start by typing everything down. So not really thinking about the subject, but just everything that's in my head, just typing it down. And then I start reading out loud. And by reading out loud, I actually get the feeling with the subject. And I think, this is the focus point. This is not that interesting. Let's take it out. And then I write, I think it's almost like a piece of 600 words. It's a first draft. I send it to Merel. She looks at it and then she says, this part is interesting that you can maybe put more examples in it or write a bit more about it. That one, not that interesting, just leave it out. And on that basis, we make a structure of an article. And then nowadays, because we found out that formula that works for me, the articles get read way better. And it works also faster for me now that I get a hold on it, how I should write.
Mm-hmm.
But I know colleagues of mine do it on a totally different way. They first make a structure and then fill in the structure. And it's figuring out what works for you.
Oh, yeah.
And Merel is quite a personal manager. So she always looks at the person and then thinks, okay, let's figure out what works for Charlotte and make a list of subjects that work for her and create a formula that works for her to make better articles. Yeah.
Sounds really good.
Yeah, she's an amazing manager.
Yeah. Are you also working on a structure where you can do it solo?
Yeah, I also write articles solo. It's the more longer pieces go to Merel. We also have a structure in the editorial team. So the shorter ones just go to colleagues of mine. Yeah, that's because Milo can't handle everything. So it's only like the large pieces who make the magazine. And that those pieces are around 1,000 or more words. And the smaller ones, I just, we have a structure that I go to. Yeah, Reynold, it's my colleague of urban planning. He reads my articles. But always someone of the team reads an article. Mm. So we don't publish an article that's not read by an editor.
And how much do you use AI to assist you in what?
I don't. I'm a bit afraid of it, but I know my colleague of web redactor, the web editor, she uses it because she creates the news messages every day. It's a lot of work, so AI is a tool for her. And I know that Reynold uses it to do a bit of research because sometimes we have huge PDF files of projects and political statements, and then AI can help in searching like the focus points in the PDF. But I think I'm a bit old school. I just want to read everything. Not the most practical element in time management. But and I sometimes have a feeling maybe because of AI, the personal elements get lost in articles. You're reading an article by me, so I want to create it myself, so that people also know a bit about me and what my interests are and how I write things. I think it's super interesting if you read columns at NRC of Parool and you know the author, and then you can already imagine how a piece will be. I don't think AI has the feeling to create that.
I say never, but I fully agree. I'd rather read something that you made. Do you consider yourself, because a lot of people follow you for what you write and what you stand for and think, do you see yourself as a personal brand?
Not yet. It's a good question. I have a few friends of mine who already asked me this one because they believe that I can be an influencer on a larger scale. I'm not an influencer, people. I have a few thousand followers on Instagram. But I have a feeling that it's becoming my own brand because I also do freelance jobs aside from the architect. Those are always like organizations who contact me for me because they want Charlotte Thomas to moderate or create an exhibition text. So it's something that I'm thinking about more. Maybe I should make it my own brand. I don't know. I have a Kafka. I have my like freelance.
So what do you think when you think about, am I or am I not a personal brand? What is going on in your mind?
It sounds like a big step in my mind. And I don't know if I'm, first of all, I have self-doubt. Am I good enough to become a brand and promote myself as a brand? Like Charlotte Thomas, who knows everything about So the self-doubt is a big part of it. And also maybe to become more professional. I now have a structure at a magazine that works fine for me. I have my freelance on the side. I think maybe in the future, I'm thinking about becoming a freelancer again because I started as a freelancer. Yeah, it's an in-between one. I think I'm a bit frightened to make that step.
It's not advice, but for me, when I know you a bit, maybe it's not even needed to make a choice. Am or am I not? Maybe the label is a little bit too big. And just go forward, do what you love. You're already there because what you say, you have a couple of thousand followers. There's a reason for it.
Yeah. Well, I sometimes thought about making like vlogs about architecture. We do it also at Architect. And I think it's super interesting to create pictures, first of all, but also to make video material about all the projects that I visit. Every week I go to new places. I visit new architecture and the reach that I can create to making people familiar with architecture and the impact it has on people on a daily basis. That sometimes I thought that maybe I should make vlogs. But then
But you didn't.
But I didn't. I do it as Architect and it works a bit. Yeah, but it's a good question. It's a question that's a bit in my mind. And I'm also a bit afraid if you make that step, well, you don't say it, it's really a step, but that I maybe lose my personal connection with the subject and also with the people. Now I have a small group of followers and I have quite a direct contact with people I don't know. I only know them by name, by Instagram, but they contact me every time they see a nice project or they're intrigued by, well, where were you? Or who created it? Or how was it? Yeah, that maybe if it becomes bigger, then you lose that connection or something. I don't know. But this is a good question to think more about in the future.
I think a lot of people think about it the same with me. Before I started Don't Waste Time.
Yeah, but you just went for it.
Well, it took some time.
Yeah.
And I was really doubting, is it going to be Bastian, or is there like a theme or a mission?
Yeah.
Because I concluded I don't want to be in the spotlight. I rather stay behind the scenes and make it easier for others to do whatever they do. And then the mission is, reaching for the potential growth of others. And then Don't Waste I is basically the statement that you make. But I like to stay at home or at a party behind the people who want to speak.
Yeah, but that's then a good choice that you have the title of Don't Waste I, because people reach to me because of my name. If I want to make it a bigger, then I need to change my name, because otherwise I will be in the spotlight because it's my name.
Yes, for you it's different.
Yeah. It's a good food of thought.
What I learned is don't make it too complicated.
Yeah.
And I think you're doing quite well already by just being you. Well, next is, do you see yourself as ambitious? What does ambition mean to you, and how do you measure your progress as a professional?
That was quite funny yesterday evening. I mentioned that question to my boyfriend. I don't see myself as an ambitious person, but I think the people around me see me as an ambition.
Yeah.
And they think that I have huge ambitions. My boyfriend is always like, oh, you're way too ambitious. I support you in everything, so do your thing. But he's quite peaceful and toned down. He doesn't get like frustrated for work stuff. I do. I work sometimes in the evenings. But I think my ambition is, I'm quite an enthusiastic person. I'm passionate about architecture. Yeah, I was brought up also in the architecture world. So for me, it's not really an ambition. It's just my field of interest. So when I finish work at 5 or 6, it doesn't feel like finishing work because I read at night. So my ambition just goes on at night. But I think career-wise, there are a few things that I still want to reach for. I think like working as a curator for an architecture center. Yeah, I think that's an amazing job, especially with my now field of knowledge, to create exhibitions and make people aware of urban planning, how the urban spaces work, how everybody has a memory with architecture. It's like unconsciousness of architecture. People are affected by it on a daily basis. And yeah, working as a curator, you can make exhibitions that on like a level that also lands with just people. Because now I write for quite a niche. It's only like architects and urban planners and interior designers, to make it a more like a broader story.
And you also mentioned the niche. And is the niche then also national or international? How?
Yeah, the architect was originally Benelux. So the magazine had a huge range in the Netherlands, Belgium and Luxembourg. But the last couple of years is mostly focused on the Netherlands. When I was also a part of the team, like I think I'm now 2 years an official part of the team. I also worked as a freelancer for the architect. We also started writing a bit more about Belgium. Quite interesting, because in the beginning, Dutch architects needed to mention that when I came with the team and when I was also a part of the team, they were not really happy that the focus shifted to Belgium. So I was the one to blame. I wrote 2 articles about a project in Belgium. So I was like, why? I think we can learn from each other, Belgium, the Netherlands. But yeah, it's mainly focused on the Netherlands. And the niche, if I look at the offices that are subscribed to us, it's like mostly the Netherlands, a few Belgian offices, but yeah. Which is quite logical.
Do you feel like it's perfect as a skill for you to work in this market? Or do you feel a boundary and do you want to fly more around Europe, world?
I would love to do it a bit more internationally. I had a conversation with one of the founders of Frame a couple of months ago. He just retired the job at Frame and he started his own firm, and we had a conversation. And the way he talked about like architecture and design and interior design on a global scale, Yeah, I was quite intrigued by it because I'm so focused on the Netherlands. But if you just zoom out a bit more and look how on a global scale everything is changing, but also influencing each other, yeah, I think it can be super interesting. Branch out a bit. But then I needed, I think I then need to work for a magazine as Frame or, not even Elle Decoration nowadays writes super international. So I think Frame is like the main magazine who still does it on that scale.
Let me ask some do or die question, because this makes a little bridge. The first question, travel the world and get international recognition for your work, but see your family only once or twice per year, or have a balanced family life but limited professional recognition?
The second one. Yeah, my family is really important to me. I speak my parents on a daily basis. So how fascinating it may sound to fly the world and create a huge network and get inspired by people all over the world, I would choose my family, yeah.
Yes, because you also include them in your social media, well, and not once or twice.
No, it's so cute. Yeah. They don't know that it's the reach is that much. So they only think, oh yeah, picture, oh yeah, you can share it for those. They think it's mostly family who follows me, which is not. So
will they listen to the podcast?
I hope so. Yeah, I hope so. I will send it to them. They're so sweet. They're all architects. So on a daily basis, they give their feedback on articles that are published on The Architect. They also used to have the magazine at the office. So at home, we have a lot of covers from the 80s, 90s and the 2000s, which are graphically...
Absolutely.
Oh my God. So aesthetically pleasing. Back then, how magazines were made, it's a huge difference with nowadays.
Yeah.
I think we should bring it back, but yeah.
Are you more traditional?
Yeah, you can say so. But I think it's just how the world works right now with the online presence. And especially if you look at magazines, I get it that print doesn't work anymore. It's not financially interesting to create books and magazines. But I'm still the one who collects books and magazines. I love the tactility of opening a book, the smell, looking how the pictures work on different types of paper. Yeah, I don't like reading on a screen. I hate it. I have the feeling that the information and the knowledge doesn't land the same as if you read a book or a magazine. I'm also the one who puts post-its in it and lines things and colors things. And yeah, it's so maybe I'm a bit traditional for my generation, but yeah.
Joost Grotens is on the podcast as well, and he makes books. And then you're talking about craftsmanship. So we could also say that you admire the craftsmanship about how to communicate information.
Yeah, but it's a dying breed, I think. How I was contacted by the architecture department of Tilburg to give courses for the next year. And we were talking about the course plan. And I already had ideas of books that I want to introduce the students to. And the head of the department was like, yeah, books, they don't work anymore. So young students, you need to think about more like small articles and maybe like video material. She also mentioned TikTok. I think it was a joke. But how a younger generation's, how they process knowledge is totally different how I process knowledge. Quite strange because I'm not that old.
Basically, the first thing that I'm thinking is like, is this what the students also think? Or is this a teacher or dean or generation who assumes this should be.
Yeah, I think it's the last one. And I think it also depends on an individual like scale. I think, you can be a 23-year-old who loves reading and reading magazines and loves the tactility and the craftsmanship. But you can also be a 23-year-old who spends hours watching TikTok and gets his knowledge through a screen. So I also think it depends. I think it will be quite a learning process for me to get a hold on how I should tell and bring knowledge to that generation in the next couple of months.
Yeah. Can it also mean both? As in that you explain the traditional and the innovative, because you're doing both and you studied the history. And how important it is to know.
Yeah, so I think I will blend it in the course.
Thank you.
Yeah, because I think students still need to read a book. It's so fun to read a book, especially all the architecture books that are, and also the art books. It's just create your own book collection. It's such a fun thing to do. Yeah, so I will do both. I will blend it.
Good, fight for it. Be a mentor to others, but never have a mentor yourself. Or have a mentor, but never get the chance to mentor others.
I never had a mentor. Maybe then mentor others? Because I look at the... I already gave a few college subjects to different architecture universities. And I like making younger generations aware of things that are playing in architecture and art, and love making them enthusiastic about our field of work and to bring knowledge to that. So I don't know if you can call that a mentor. Yeah, maybe.
Maybe that's more teaching.
Yeah, more teaching, yeah.
Mentors maybe more on a smaller scale, one-to-one.
Yeah, then maybe I should choose maybe having a mentor. That can also be quite interesting for me because I never had it. I think I could learn a few things from a mentor.
As well. Empower female architects through writing, but never be credited for it. Or gain fame about your writing in general, but not make tangible impact.
The first one. Yeah, it's a hard one because I think recognition is still lacking in the field, but there's also a huge blind spot when it comes to knowledge. So I think we should make like a huge movement and writing female architects into history and also into contemporary context. I think we should write a lot about them. We should also recognize them. But if I have to choose, then I would choose the amount of knowledge that we can write and then not the recognition in comparison.
I can tell from your body language and tone of voice that this particular subject is dear to you. We'll dive into it later. Experience rapid career growth but deal with high stress, or have a slow but steady career but low stress?
The low stress level and the steady career. I have the feeling that it's my career is also the steady going. Yeah. It's not that I had one impact and then everything changed. It's steady.
Focus on the empowerment of women in architecture, or focus on the preservation of architectural history?
Good question, Bastiaan. Can I say both? Yeah, I think
it's profiling you.
Yeah, it's. I think that the conservation of architecture history is important because I think we now, especially if I look at what I learned at universities, it's quite a monofunctional history that I learned about. It was male dominated, white male dominated, totally lacking female role models. Also, other role models were totally lacking. So I would say both. We should conserve the history and then also focus on female representation and that kind of stuff in the history part. Yeah.
Be restricted to writing about architecture in one country, or travel constantly but only write short pieces.
Mix of both? Yeah, no. I love the focus that I have nowadays in my work that's just focused on Belgium and the Netherlands, and we can write in-depth pieces, have a network of architects around us and have conversation on a quite personal level. Perfect. But sometimes I think, travel the world, small, superficial pieces would also be interesting to create a more larger network. I don't know, maybe a combination of both. Yeah.
Okay. Last question in this category. Only interview renowned architects or only interview emerging talents?
The last one. Yeah. Focus on the new generation. Yeah. I think that's super important. I talked to Julian van Sticht of Lefse Architects a few weeks ago. And the only thing that he could say to me was, you're the new generation. You will change architecture in the Netherlands. So I think the new generation. I love talking to young talents and emerging offices and how they approach the field. Yeah, it's so interesting.
What is interesting?
Yeah, how they navigate themselves. I have a few friends of mine who are now starting their own offices. It's really hard to start your own office, first of all. And if I look at them, there's an office called Walden. It's based in Rotterdam, and they're focused on circularity and nature-based design, and so specific. They have a niche, but it works for them so well. And I think that a lot of the questions that we are facing in architecture are about sustainability and circularity, and they are a booming business. And in the beginning, it was super hard for them because it was so niche, but they said true, and now they have a few assignments with larger firms, and it's rolling. So I think that's quite inspiring that they chose so specific for one subject. And then I know that there are a few. Yeah, Derief, it's also a Rotterdam-based office. They do a lot of research. Yeah, the fun things that they do on exhibition design and then translate it to also research design. And they also give a lot of lectures. They're doing good stuff. And they also have the combination of Belgium. They're also located in Brussels and in Rotterdam. So they're doing a lot of stuff in Belgium also. And they talk about the different scales of assignments they have in Belgium in comparison to the Netherlands. In Belgium, they can build... actually like a whole community And then in the Netherlands, they're way too young, so they can only do exhibition design. So it's their responsibilities are on a totally different scale. And that tells a bit also about how Belgium and the Netherlands differ in how architecture is created, I guess. So yeah, I like talking to the young generations, yeah.
Do you also want or see the need to help them with the skills and talents that you have? Do you feel somehow, and I ask this to many podcast questions, feel a responsibility for your generation or future generations?
I guess a bit. At The Architect, we have a feature called Startup and also Young Talent online. Yeah, and that feature, I think also Merel and the other editors feel responsible to tell the story of the young generations. We always focus then on one firm and then tell their whole like history, how the firm came by, what their main focus points are. And also the friends of mine at Walden, we have conversation about how they can communicate projects better, how their social media can work better. So yeah, maybe I feel a bit responsible to help them navigate in this field. Yeah.
Would you also consider be more a consultant to them?
Yeah, I can see myself doing that. Yeah. But then, yeah, I can also refer to my PR manager job at Galerie Bart. It was a bit the same. I was a bit of a consultant of artists. They told me their story, the story behind artworks. I was the one who made text about it. And my responsibility was to make sure that that story landed with the people who visited the exhibitions. Okay. So like the in-between person, I think that that's an interesting role.
Yeah, because this is one of the questions I have for later on, but we can dive into it right now, because you did several different things during your career till so far. And one of them was being a PR manager at Galerie Bart, but also work at Vice, be an assistant for a film director. I really like it. The diversity and trying, exploring, finding all the things that you probably can do well. I just wondered, why PR manager? But now you already gave a little bit the answer.
Yeah, and it was also, I must say, it was also COVID times back then. So I used to work at a museum called Museum Schip. It's a museum about Amsterdam School. It's a typical architecture, a brick expressionism in Amsterdam and also in other parts of the Netherlands. And COVID came by and the museum needed to close. And then I was re-evaluating myself. Yeah, I was at home for almost 3 months. I thought, where am I good at? What would I want to do? I was missing the art world a bit because I'm educated also as art historian. So, and I was working in architecture and I was like, yeah, maybe I should orientate back to the art world. And then Galerie Bart came by. It's an Amsterdam-based gallery. It's quite known in Amsterdam and they have a huge range of artists, which I find interesting. You can't really tell this is typical Galerie Bart. They had photographers and sculptors and painters. And from every discipline, there was an artist. I saw the function online and there was a friend of mine already working there. And I was like, why not? I can see myself as a PR. I'm a people person. I like talking. I like also translating stories on different media. I love social media. I love writing text for exhibitions. So I had a conversation with the team of Galerie Bart and it was an instant click. And it was not only PR. So I also helped with curating the exhibitions. But my main focus point was being the chain between the artists and the public that will see their art. Yeah, that was so interesting to have those conversations because mostly artists, they do their thing and they're mostly not that good at writing. A bit stuck in their head also. So to be that person to bring out their focus points and to make it into a text that will also translate their whole ideology to people. Yeah, that was, yeah. It was a lovely job to do and also create events, which I also like doing. So at Galerie Bart, we started doing movie nights and yeah, different kinds of tours at night to create different ways of approaching art and to look at art. It's not only a white cube. You can do so much more with an art space. Yeah.
If I may ask, what does your partner do?
My partner is also an artist. Yeah, so he's also an architect. He's educated as an architect and a landscape architect to be specific. But nowadays, he makes art about urban space. I also met him because I visited an exhibition of him. So yeah, it's quite funny how our in field of interests is also the field of work we also navigate in. So that's quite practical also sometimes.
Yeah, because you mentioned that your work never really stops during the day. You actually bring it home or it is already home. How much do you have conversations with your partner about what you do, what you think, because he was quite down to earth, more-ish than you. Does it intertwine? Is it more like separate? How does it work for you?
On a daily basis. Yeah, it's we talk a lot about architecture and art. I also read, when I'm working on an article, a trick that works for me is reading it out loud to maybe like see faults that I made or weird sentences, and I read it to him. So he always gives feedback on articles, and I always give feedback on the art that he's making. I help writing his texts when he's having an exhibition or wants to get funding. So yeah, on a daily basis, it's, yeah, we all also scroll on our Instagram and then, oh, look at this artist. Whoa. So it's
just for the listener, I see your face and it lights up.
Yeah.
It's super nice to see.
Yeah, it's, I'm really happy that I found him.
Mm.
First of all, because the fact that he's so peaceful and down to earth works perfect for me, because sometimes at night when I'm still behind my laptop, and I'm asking him questions about an article or a subject, he will be, Charlotte, it's not groundbreaking work that you're doing. It's not life-changing. Just put the laptop down, chill together, maybe watch a movie or a documentary. But the fun fact is that if we're watching a documentary, it's mostly art or architecture orientated. So it's so intertwined in our daily life. And yeah, if we go outside, we have a bit of the same way how we look at urban spaces. And he also makes funny photos about weird things, how people navigate in urban spaces or how they design their houses or gardens. It's and then he will use it for his art. So, yeah.
And it never gets bored?
Nope.
That's good.
And that's good, right?
Yeah.
I had a lot of conversations with friends about the fact that the men that have been in my life as partners are always in the creative business. So I noticed there was a friend of mine who said, you're a bit judgmental that you only want to date people who work also in the fields that you're active in. That was a wake-up call. I was like, maybe. But I think for me it works because I'm so passionate about it and it's so inherent in my life that I can't imagine maybe being with someone who's not in this world, because nonstop I'm thinking about how things are created in art and architecture. So it would be quite strange for me to need to explain myself every time or something. Yeah. So I don't know. Yeah. I like the art and architecture world.
How important is the hashtag me neither to you?
Good question. It's a hashtag that was created by the Dutch artist Madelon Vriesendorp. She was also the wife of Rem Koolhaas. They set up OMA together, also with two other persons. Yeah, the hashtag, I got familiar with it in 2018 because it was a tag that she created in her acceptance speech for the Architectural Review. She got an award for, I think it was like female representation in the field. And in her acceptance speech, she was talking about the fact that she didn't have the recognition in the beginning of her career. She was a huge part of the OMA aesthetics back then. She created a lot of their artworks and collages and also the cover of books, and she didn't get the recognition. So instead of saying me too, me neither, like I was also not recognized for it. And the hashtag in 2018 got quite huge range in the architecture field, because it was the year after the hashtag me too affair also in architecture with Richard Meyer and sexual intimidation on the work floor. So me neither was like the second hashtag that put a spotlight on the fact that a lot of female architects didn't get the recognition. And that's something I, since 2018, strive for. So I already started in 2018 giving lectures about it and always mentioned Madelon Vriesendorp. Yeah, because her name, I knew that she was the wife of Rem Koolhaas, but I didn't know the impact that she had on the aesthetic of OMA. So it was for me also eye-opening. And then the fact that a hashtag gave me that insight, yeah, I put a huge importance to it, yeah. Still nowadays, yeah.
The question then is why? But not in the way like, why should you? But more like, yes, I fully agree. But where does it come from a personal perspective? What drives you so much to?
Yeah, in my studies, well, especially in Belgium, I studied for 5 years, so I did an extra year, and then that was only courses in the architecture department at the university, and never was a female architect mentioned as an architect. So if there was a female mentioned, it was because she was a muse, or she gave financial support for the first project of the architect, or something like that. But it was not a woman fully in her own power creating something. Which I found in my last year, I was like, how? Why? Women were already at academics. Well, they already were allowed at the academies of architecture in the beginning of 20th century. So where are those ladies? And if they were mentioned in the books, they were always like the lover or the ex-lover. Or I thought it was so strange. And then, yeah, I dived into the subject and I got familiar with Lina Bobardi. Mm-hmm. It's an Italian-Brazilian, nowadays super hyped. Back then in 2010, not that hyped. There were only like Portuguese publications about her work. And I was flabbergasted by the immense portfolio of works that she created and the social aspect in it. And then, yeah, I totally dived in also the representation of female architects in the Netherlands. And I think, yeah, there's so many voices not heard yet that need to be heard. So then I think the representation is super important, especially as a historian. We have the power to rewrite history. Let's take that opportunity and do it.
That's why I asked this do or die question a bit, like write about women empowerment or rewrites write about the history of architecture in general, because it's so intertwined for you. And you also wrote an essay about it, about actually rewriting Dutch architectural history. What feelings did you have when writing this? Do you see this as a cornerstone moment in your career?
Yeah, it was Merel Pitt, so my current manager, you could say editor-in-chief, who contacted me to write the essay for the publication Mevrouw de Architect, so Mrs. Architect. It's a Dutch publication about representation of female architects. And she contacted me and she was like, do you want to write something about it? I saw that you already gave lectures about it. So maybe let's put it together. It's quite a condensed essay, so it's not rewriting history. It's a start point to rewrite history. And I just navigated and looked in history and saw that in the 20s, there were like five female architects who were at the Academie of Bouwkunst in Amsterdam. And then also at Delft. And I looked up what happened to them. A lot of them didn't make the career because they were, first of all, female. And when a female married back then, you stopped having a function because you were totally dependent of the male component in the relationship. Yeah, so then the essay came by. And first of all, when I collected my information and went into the archives, I was a bit angry. Must say that. Mm. I was quite angry, first of all, because the lack of archives. Yeah. If you go to het Nieuwe Instituut, totally male-dominated. Mostly male archives. And when I talked to the people of het Nieuwe Instituut, they were like, yeah, we don't get female archives. There's mostly males that... male architects that combine, they're like, yeah, I have an interest in archive. Maybe it's interesting for you. I just finished my practice. Here you have my archive. Female architects, mm-hmm. especially back then, they didn't saw themselves as important to go to a national archive. So now Nieuwe Instituut, they are doing a lot of research for those archives and making them digitally available for everyone. So in the beginning, I was a bit angry. And then when I started writing, it was also a bit of a feeling of sadness because you create almost a bond with those architects and you see that they maybe didn't have the career that you envisioned them to have. And then if you read about also what happened in Bauhaus and the lovers' affairs, and I was a bit saddened. And then at the end of the essay, I was quite proud because I saw the importance of it. It was picked up by a lot of also art historians and architecture historians that are like, yeah, this is interesting. It's a blind spot. We need to collect all the names of the females who were present in that time area. So then the ball started rolling. You can call it a cornerstone moment on that team. So in my career, because of that essay, people got known with my name. And then NIE Publishers, they published a book last year. I also contributed to it. So we created a network. Well, actually, Mevrouw de Architect was the cornerstone to participate in that magazine. And then there was like a network created by historians, but also architects. And since yeah, it was 2020, 2021. We see each other on a regular basis and talk about the field, which is super important to just create that dialogue. But yeah, it was quite a big part in my career, you can say, yeah.
Do you also believe that it is or can or will be a red line in your career?
When I wrote the essay, I thought it would be a red line in my career. But then, just if I look time management-wise, it's still a super interesting subject. Mm-hmm. And I'm always present when there are lectures about it. But I don't have the time to do the full research anymore.
No, but maybe it's not per se just the research.
Yeah, but it's still, yeah, it's a red line in my personal interest still. Yeah, when I see an exhibition somewhere in Europe about a female architect, I will take a train and go to it. Mm. So I went to the Charlotte Perriand one at the Louis Vuitton Institute in Paris a few years ago. It was her first exhibition about her work, which is strange because she's already so many years not present with us, and she created such a huge portfolio and made such a huge impact. So yeah, it will be a red line. Yeah, it will be a red line. Yeah.
Even if you would say no, I would still reconsider. Yeah. During this conversation, there are two moments that I will never forget. And that's that you light up when you talk about a relationship with your partner, which is so good. And about this topic.
Yeah.
The passion, the angriness, the not rebel-ish, but more the activism, maybe, if you would like to call it.
Yeah, and which is also because, yeah, Merel, it was her concept, Mevrouw de Architect. And then she became editor-in-chief of The Architect, like the magazine. She fought for it to make it still a feature in the magazine. So every print, there's a feature called Mevrouw de Architect. And then she has conversations with females in the contemporary field of architecture. It's still so important.
Have you found the answer to your question in this essay, where are the Dutch female architects of the 90s and 20s?
Yeah, it's so funny. A lot of people always ask me that one. I ended the essay. First of all, I had a strict limit of words. So you could write a book about it. It already happened since then. I found them. And I know that the Francine Hubens and Elisabeth van der Poels were present back at that time. But something that I discovered after the essay that contributes to the question, where are those female architects in that time period, is the archive Vrouwen Bouwen Wonen. It's like female building living. And I was not familiar with it. So that happened after the essay. The archive is now in hands of Nieuw Instituut. But to just like give a context, it's an Institute of Female Architects that were present in the 80s till, I think, beginning of the 90s. And they fought for female representation in the field, but they also made a lot of designs about how we can make the urban space more female friendly, more inclusive. Like all the topics that we were still debating nowadays, they already did it in the 80s. And that was also like gave advice for the government and that kind of stuff. But that was an archive. Didn't know it. It was a total blind spot in my knowledge. So that was a good discovery after the essay. And now the archive is being, I think Nieuw Instituut is making it digitally available, but also interviewing still the females who contributed to the Vrouwen Bouwen Institute. So yeah, it's still a living archive, which is quite interesting.
Talking about the discovery part, is that something you didn't discover, but which was handed over to you as one of the biggest tips in your life? If I may call it like this, is from your parents who are architects, and they said, if you're going to study, don't study architecture.
True. It's totally true. Well, I must say my whole family worked in architecture. My grandparents on both sides were building engineers. So then there it starts already. And then my dad is an architect. My mother is, you call it in Dutch landmeters. It's like a land surveyor. But she also contributed to the office. She made all the plan material. And then I also have a few uncles that are architects. I have an aunt and an uncle that had an interior. So we grew up in a bubble.
And they said no more.
Yeah, but that was good because I also have an older brother. He doesn't do anything with the creative architecture world. His choice, I get it. But all our vacations when we were a child, we only went visiting architecture. So from a young age, the way we look at the building environment it's totally different than, yes, someone who doesn't grow up in an architecture family. So for me, it was normal. It was just like, oh, yeah, I will go in architecture. And then when I was 18 and in high school, you need to think about, oh, which studies should I do? I wanted to do architecture first and then also textile design. But that's like in Belgium, Hogeschool H. Yeah, I think it's HBO level here. And my parents were like, nope. Nope, you're not going into the field. You saw as a child how many hours we make. And it's true, my father was never at home at night because those were the hours that his clients were at home. So when he could discuss projects or make sketches, or that were the hours. So as a child, yeah, my mom was at home making the plan material and the scale modules, but my father was never at home. So they were like, nope, you're not going to do it. You should do university. Maybe start with art history and then, yeah, but then in art history, I chose the architecture side of it. So I'm a bit in the field, but I'm more reflecting on it and writing and not designing it. So it's a bit in between. But yeah, I sometimes still think about the fact maybe I should study architecture. Yeah, I think it's you can make such a huge impact on so many levels in society. Yeah.
Ever considered, what if I step out of it like my brother at all? What would it be?
I did. So context, 2017 was not my year. That was a year that, yeah, people call it burnout. I think it's just like a huge title, a label to put people in a certain box. But in 2017, because I was a person who always said yes to everything and did everything for free, I totally crossed my boundaries. That was also a tip of my psychologist back then. First of all, I needed to reevaluate myself and also think about the fact, why do I work in architecture? Is it because my parents do it? And was it something that was put on me? Is it actually my own interest? So that was when she asked me that question, and it was also an exercise with it to think about it. Yeah, that was like, wow, I never thought about the fact that I'm sort of like imprinted about my career path just because my whole family did it. So the fact that I need to do stand still with it and think about, does it actually give me energy, or does it cost me energy, or does it actually make me happy? Tip from my psychologist was like, just stop for a year, say goodbye to the art world and goodbye to architecture, which was hard in the beginning. But then I just worked at a vintage store, totally different scale of work level, also super interesting. And then after a year, also just like being in therapy and working on myself and setting boundaries, I reintegrated in the architecture world, but really slowly, because I wanted to feel if it still makes me happy and gives me energy, which of course it did.
What is slow for you?
Good question. What is slow for me? If I think about that period, it took me 2 years to slowly reintegrate into the field. So yeah, is that slow? For me, it was slow. Yeah, for me, it was slow because also going in therapy was a slow process for me. I needed to learn to navigate on a lower pace in life. But that was also, yeah, the problem why I crossed my boundaries, because as a person, I'm super enthusiastic about a lot of things. And then I always go on a train. It's like a fast train. And then I want to do everything 100%, even more. So that was a good lesson for me to step back. My psychologist back then, she was wonderful how she helped me in that. And it was actually an exercise for me to not have a full agenda, have it empty and create blocks of peacefulness. And I needed to create a block to walk and read a book. And that was, yeah. I needed to step back and create a slower pace. And then it took me 2 years to... But it was a good learning process for me to nowadays know my boundaries. I can feel on a mental level, but also on a physical level when I'm approaching those boundaries. So then it's always like a small wake-up call of, oop, watch out. You're going back into that zone. Step back, reevaluate. Yeah, but
I'm very happy that you shared this, because in other podcasts, there's similarities to this and how important it can or is to have someone else reflect on what you do. And knowing you a bit, you're very talented, and I like the enthusiasm, and I see the train as well. And I see this also as a very good component, but that you also described that you learned to have certain habits and structures to actually say no to things. What would you consider next to meditation the most important thing that you will always keep?
I think if I compare myself before 2017 and when opportunities came by, I always said yes. I didn't even talk about it with people. It was like always, yes. And next to meditation, nowadays when an opportunity unfolds, first of all, before saying yes, I will talk with someone about it. I have really close friends who were also present in 2017-18 when I was not doing my best. And they are sometimes more aware of the boundaries. So now I always talk to a certain friend, Denise. Shout out to Denise. She always calls herself my manager. And then I reflect and then she will be like, is it important enough? Do you have time for it? Is it really something that it's needed? Or is it just something that makes you happy for a short time period and you want to say yes just to help those people? Because I'm a bit of a people pleaser. To have the dialogue with her and also with my boyfriend or my family, that also helps. So I think that part I will keep. Some people have a coach for that to do. I have my personal manager. So yeah, that's a component that gives me structure on how I navigate with my freelance. My 9-to-5 job also gives me structure. There is also a reason why I navigated to going into a 9-to-5 job as a freelancer. It gives me peace of mind. First of all, you have structure in your daily practice and it gives also financial structure at the end of the month. Yeah, it's
well, and it's also interesting because the 9-to-5 helps you in a structure, but then when you come home, you still...
Yeah, and it's like I'm still searching for the balance because when I first started at the architect, I didn't do any freelance next to it. And after a year, missing is such a huge word, but I thought, well, maybe I should do it again because I still find it quite interesting to work on a small project for a short period of time, help. Mostly these are friends of mine who want to create a project text or an exhibition text, help those people. So then I started slowly accepting a bit freelance assignments. I just had a period when, once again, good learning process, where I said yes to too many and in a small condensed period of time. So it was a wake-up call for me once again. Oh, okay, yeah, now I'm pushing the limits. And then once again, my boyfriend or my friends will say, you're not present anymore. You don't have time for your social activities. Are you okay? And then my response was always, yeah, I needed to finish this or that. The deadline is then. And then they will say to me, well, Charlotte, just maybe put those freelance assignments a bit back.
Sounds like a couple of good friends.
Yeah, they're amazing. I'm so grateful that I got to learn, well, get to know those people in the Netherlands.
Was it also hard to reach out and ask for assistance or help? Because there in that component, you also admit that you can't do it on your own and maybe the feelings of failure and FOMO and I don't know, all the bunch that everyone is dealing with, but you don't see it happen on the streets and you don't hear it from so many others.
Personally, I needed to learn how to ask people for help. In my job at Galerie Bart, one of the first feedbacks was super interesting. I worked there for, I think, 2 months and we had a feedback conversation. And my manager back then, also Merel de Kok, her first feedback was that you don't ask for help. You want to do everything by yourself and you don't have to do it. It was also the first time for me that I was always a freelancer and at Galerie Bart, I worked in a team. So it's a totally different dynamic. In a team, you can... Tasks can be held by a lot of people. You don't need to do all the tasks yourself. As a freelancer, you do everything by yourself. So for me, it was kind of a shift in how I approached assignments that I could ask her for help or maybe another colleague or also just say no to it and gave the task to another colleague. So that was something I really needed to learn. But if I look at as a freelancer, I think I just learned to do everything by myself. And still nowadays in the team, you see the difference between the colleagues who are first freelancers and the colleagues who are always set in a 9-to-5 job. You see that there's a different kind of approach in work. You can see that the freelancers from our editorial team are the ones who are still working at night. It's still something to find a balance in.
What has having worked as an assistant film director brought you in a skill development?
Yeah, I work for AFFR. It's the Architecture Film Festival in Rotterdam, also during COVID. If I think back at that time period, it was such a hard period for the cultural sector. But for me, it was like booming business, which I still can't imagine how that happened. But I work for AFFR as editor for their program. And the skill that it brought me the most was the moderation skill. So for the people who don't know AFFR, it's almost a week-long architecture films that are programmed in Lantaarnvenster, a cinema in Rotterdam. And next to just watching movies, there were always like conversations with the maker of the movie or with people we did research about a certain topic that is presented in the movie. So for me as an editor, for 5 days long, I needed to have conversations with the public and with the makers. And I hadn't done that before. And the team of AFFA was like, just do it. You like talking to people, just go for it. And the first time I was super stressed. I was like, maybe I don't have good questions. How will the public interact on my questions? How do I connect the public with the maker? But because it was COVID, so everything went online. So all the directors were called in online. So it was like a huge error bit in my head. And then just by doing it for a few days, I found love for moderation. It's so interesting how you can be once again like in between the maker and the public and tell stories by asking questions. And so the element that I also did at Galerie Bart actually also was present in that moderation. So that skill I really learned. And nowadays I sometimes do moderation for institutes.
It's quite a big thing that you did over there. And you're asked to do something that you never did. And it's quite in the spotlight.
Yeah.
I'm asking this question because then you're in the comfort zone. And then all of a sudden you need to step out and quite fast in the spotlight. What kind of things did you develop for yourself, consciously or unconsciously, to just do it? Because asking for a lot of other people, like maybe that's too much. And you mentioned I get a lot of stress or errors. But what happens between the question and the moment you do it? Is it for you just like, yeah, okay, it's just do it? But I never believe someone saying this because there's so much going on in your mind.
I can't either. I can't imagine that people say, I just do it. I read a lot. So I had really short nights at AFFA because I wanted to know everything about the movie, everything about the maker, even read about the public that was present the day before. I wanted to know all the facts so that it gave me a bit of security in asking questions. Because I can't imagine that you just stand for a huge public. I think it was back then COVID, there was not that many people sitting in the cinema area, but still there were people present, and just do it. I always have the feeling that I have the responsibility to honor the work of the maker and then also to create questions that the public wants to ask. You can't stand before a public and just say, well, what was the idea behind your movie? No, you need to know the knowledge and compare it to other movies that the maker did. Yeah, I read a lot about everyone that was present at AFFA. And that's a system that I still use nowadays. Just totally dive into a person or totally dive into an office or a project and know all the ins and outs so that I feel secure in my knowledge before going into a conversation with someone else. Yeah.
Why did you go to Vice?
Yeah, Vice was, I think it was 2016, 17, 18. I was just living in Amsterdam and I got known with a lot of people who worked at Vice back then. Vice back then was huge. So that was like their thriving area. A lot of like young creatives were working back then and they had the vertical called Creators. I don't know if people still know it, but Vice, yeah, they do their like rock and roll kind of articles, but they had a vertical called Creators and that was orientated to the art world. And they wrote a lot of articles about like exhibitions in Amsterdam and throughout the whole of the Netherlands. And their editor back then, Ton, was a friend of mine. And Ton was following me on Instagram. And he was intrigued by the way I looked at architecture. And then he contacted me if I was maybe open up to write articles for Vice about architecture and look if it would land with the audience of Vice, because it's quite a young audience. It's quite picture image orientated public. And then I was like, yeah, okay, let's give it a try. And fun fact, back then, Mark Menkjan, like the architecture critic, he also wrote for Vice about architecture. So I wrote a few pieces, he wrote a few pieces, and it worked. It was quite funny to see that if you put a bit of humor in architecture, because sometimes it can be very serious business, but the articles that we wrote, it had a bit of humor. I went to Almere and showed the beauty of Almere. And in Amsterdam, everybody says, I don't want to find myself dead in Almere. They always look down at Almere. I don't get it. Architecture-wise, urban planning-wise, super interesting topic. I also showed the beauty of the electricity houses in Amsterdam, but also the tradition of it in the Netherlands. If you look at an electricity house, it's mostly like, yeah, it's a beautiful house. The 1920s, 30s, 40s, it was like a brick house in urban planning. So I wrote a few funny articles about architecture, and then that was not it worked, but then creators got shut down because of financial reasons at Vice. So then it just ended. I learned a lot about writing and owning my voice or something in architecture, because they were so fond of it. And then it gave me like the confidence. So yeah, it was a good learning experience, and also the importance of image. Yeah.
Vice on their website talking about how they describe themselves. Vice strives to capture the people at the heart of stories and focus on the ideas, issues, and the context other outlets miss. If Tom or someone else calls you and said, would you like to lead Vice and bring it back to where it was, or would you consider?
I think so. Yeah, because the legacy of Vice, I grew up with Vice. I know that younger generations are not familiar with it anymore, because their reach, especially in the Netherlands, it's quite low. They only publish like English and translated to Dutch articles nowadays. But back then, Vice was like the main focus point for culture, cultural education. As a teenager, everybody read Vice, and it went from articles about, getting known with limits in alcohol or drugs, but it also went to art and also female body and empowerment. And it was such an important platform also with the magazine, and especially also in America, how the impact that Vice created throughout the years. So if they would reimagine creating the creators vertical, I would be open to that. Yeah. I don't know if it would work still, but I'm open to that. Yeah.
I would love to see you run such a platform or magazine or something else that you initiate.
In a few years.
In a few years. So you study history. You talk a lot about the empowerment of women history now. You talk a lot about the Vice and that it's not relevant or not so much. Do you live more in the past, present, or the future?
Yeah, now at my position at Architect, I live in the present, because we write about current projects, which was also a switch for me to do, because my knowledge lies in history. So when I first started at Architect, I knew a bit of like Dutch architecture firms and who are now leading and who are now upcoming. But for me, it was in the beginning, Merel gave me just a list of current architecture firms that are making headlines, and that was also a learning curve for me to get familiar with it. So nowadays I live for my position in the present, but if I look at personal, I'm mostly living in the past. Yeah, I find it quite interesting. Also, when I just navigate in cities, I always want to know the historical context of things and then compare it to nowadays. And I think the past, I find all the layers of history super interesting, and then connect it to the present.
Because you mentioned this morning, I'm at my bike at Central Station, Rotterdam. I'll cycle to you. And I made a small route from the metro in front. And I was like, she's never going to do that.
No, I want to see everything, do everything by bike or just walk.
Yeah.
And when in the beginning of my studies, we did art history in Belgium. We did a lot of like city trips with friends. Back then, super cheap. And my friends always said that, in Dutch we say stevenek. It's like a stiff neck. And they said it because when they are with me on a city trip, you always look up to buildings or to facades. I'm always like, oh, look there. They find it super annoying. I once had a boyfriend who just said, oh, just stop it. I'm tired of it. And my passion sometimes goes a bit too far for some people.
How did you learn yourself meditation?
I had to. I was totally stuck with myself. And
yes, but how actually sitting down and then knowing how much you're so in the present, and it's personal what you think about, so I don't need to know. But how did you learn yourself to block it at that moment? But when you're leaving this conversation and go back into the city, then it goes sponge again?
My psychologist, she learned it to me during sessions with her. It was really hard. And she already saw from the first appointment that I'm quite eager to learn. So her approach was to give me a lot of different exercises, also meditation exercises, just to get familiar with it, with the habit. So in the beginning, she guided me. So I didn't do it myself. I couldn't imagine being by myself in a room and just start meditating. My head was not at that space to do it. So through her, I learned it. And then also because she gave scientific-based information about meditation. So to feed my eager to learn, and then it became a pattern. And then now we're 5 years further and I still do it every day. So now it's just a habit. But in the beginning, I was like a bit skeptical also about it. But yeah, she made me sit down and then just starts for a few minutes and then longer. And she guided in the beginning and then it just stopped and I did it by myself in silence. Yeah.
Thank you for today.
Thank you for the conversation. And also thank you for the questions, because it gave me an opportunity to look a bit at my career and stand still with everything that is going on in my life. And it was also like a moment of pause. And so thank you.
That was Charlotte Thomas. From her passion for architecture and art history to her mission to highlight the overlooked contributions of female architects, Charlotte's story is one for advocacy, resilience and creativity. Her commitment to rewriting history and empowering the next generation through thoughtful communication and writing leaves us all inspired to reflect on our own contributions and the legacy we create. Charlotte reminds us that architecture isn't just about buildings, it's about the memories, stories and social impact they embody. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to click the follow button, rate the podcast, subscribe to the newsletter and spread the word, so we can continue to grow the Don't Waste Eye podcast. And remember, everyone struggles, and that's okay. But standing still prevents you from growing and reaching your potential. Keep moving forward, because the better you become, the more you'll inspire others. Don't waste your time, don't waste your eye.